Welcome. I'm glad you came through the threatening snowstorm. I mean, this is great. I just have to share with you something I learned this morning. The last time that State Secretary Romulo was here was, I think, the 19th and 20th of December of last year. Now, if you may remember, that was the last time we got 20 inches of snow. Okay. So I have concluded that there's a dangerous correlation between the state secretaries coming to Washington and snowstorms. So we're going to make this last until 4 o'clock so that he'll be here for the next week, I think, you know, because it sounds like we're going to have one heck of a snowstorm here today. No, seriously, it's a great privilege to welcome the state secretary back with us. He's a longtime friend and of course, knows Washington so very, very well, and is what we need in Washington, which is a friend who helps us understand the truth. You know, not all friends speak as clearly as we sometimes need to hear, and I think it's the best sign of true friendship when you hear both things you want to hear and you hear things that you'd rather not hear, but you hear them with the spirit that gives you confidence that it's meant with goodwill and conviction. And so we're very grateful for that. We think this is going to be a very good, very good morning. We've got lots, I think, to learn from you. It'd be great. There's so much that is now happening throughout Asia, and we're trying to think through what does it mean for America to have an Asian president or a Pacific president, and does it mean anything? Is it just simply rhetoric? What is America's relationship in a region that's changing so profoundly from the inside? I mean, these are really quite big questions. And we frankly need the candor and the objectivity of a good friend to help us think that through together. And so we look forward to this session. John Negroponte, thank you for coming.
I only had to come one block.
He only had to come one block, and he's dressed quite appropriately. He came in, he looked like Nanook of the North, and he's guaranteed of getting home. But it's really wonderful. John, as everyone knows, was our ambassador in the Philippines and has a very, very deep affection for this wonderful country. And so you're sharing it with us today, and you'll share the perspective and insights. And Ambassador Gao, thank you for everything you do to help us here with our Southeast Asia program. You're a great friend, and we look forward to many, many more opportunities to work. And thank you for facilitating this visit today. Ernie, do you want to say some introductory words before we turn it over to former sir?
No, go ahead.
Well, then let's not. I'm only here for ornamental purposes. So let's get the real program going. Foreign Secretary, why don't I ask you to come up to the podium and offer your thoughts? We look forward to a very spirited and engaging session. Thank you for coming. We're delighted to have you here.
Well, that's correct, as John said. I was here last December, and then the once-in-a-lifetime heavy snowstorm marooned me here for at least 2 days. The airport was closed. The next day, they said the flights were not sure to go. So I decided to beat a hasty retreat and went to New York, and I got my flight there. So I think the bad weather is stalking me, so here I am again. Mr. John Hummer, Ambassador John Negroponte, Mr. Ernest Bauer, guests of the CSIS, friends, I am pleased and immensely honored to be asked to speak before this inaugural Banyan Tree Leadership Forum. And I thank the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, for its very gracious invitation. This is a noteworthy initiative CSIS has taken to bring together leaders from Southeast Asia and the United States in genuine dialogue. In our rapidly changing and increasingly interconnected world, dialogue is vital for forging and framing responsive and timely policies. And indeed, through dialogue and consensus building, Southeast Asia and the United States have much to learn from each other, from deeper engagement to cooperation broader than in the past. It is in this spirit that I welcome this opportunity to share with you my country's vision as well as its policies, and in the context of the emerging Asian regional architecture, its relations and ties with the United States. In 1898, America's manifest destiny and the Filipinos' aspiration for freedom clashed and collided in a bloody guerrilla war, ending with the capture of our president, Emilio Aguinaldo, and the demise of Asia's first republic. Over time, the bitterness of the defeat and the triumphalism of empire gave way to grudging collaboration, then evolving into mutual trust and respect. Filipinos won America's admiration for their patriotism, love of country, and their steadfast and unwavering resolve to be free. And the United States committed itself to ever greater measures of self-government for its Pacific empire. Eventually, we achieved home rule through a Commonwealth in 1935 and the pledge within a decade of full independence. The outbreak of the Second World War strengthened even more the ties that joined the Philippines and the United States. In all of Asia, only the Filipinos stood as one, shoulder to shoulder with America and its allies in the war against aggression and the Axis powers. For both our countries, our peoples, Filipinos and Americans, freedom and democracy are not just abstract ideas or principles. They are real, day-to-day values we are willing to defend. Values for which we are willing to defend and pay the ultimate price. Then in the 1940s, from the foxholes of Bataan and the tunnels of Corregidor to the barbarous death march to Capas and Camp O'Donnell, now against extremism, poverty, and terrorism. At war's end in 1946, the Philippines finally attained its hard-earned and blood-earned independence. And with the signing of the 1953 Mutual Defense Treaty, the Philippines became the United States' first treaty ally in Asia. Since then, relations between our two countries have continued to move forward, and positively. They have matured into a partnership between sovereign equals. Defense cooperation has widened from joint military training exercises to cooperation in dealing with non-traditional security threats, terrorism, pandemics, natural disasters, and transnational crime. The Visiting Forces Agreement, whose validity the Philippine Supreme Court has affirmed no less than three times, and its Security Engagement Board seek to improve the defense capabilities of our two countries, as well as its soft and hard power to counter terrorist threats and radical attacks. In the quest for a just and lasting peace in Mindanao, the United States is the Philippines' staunch ally in its effort to conclude a peace agreement with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Meanwhile, development cooperation continues to improve the quality of governance and strengthening democratic institutions and processes. With the recent unanimous reselection of the Philippines as COMPAC eligible by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the partnership programs between our two countries on poverty reduction and good governance was launched. As for trade and economic linkages, they continue to flourish. American companies are investing heavily in Philippine service industries, the key ones being electronics assembly and the business process outsourcing, as well as in newly opened industrial sectors such as mining and non-conventional energy sources. People-to-people connections, too, are being constantly reinforced and renewed. The estimated 4 million Americans of Filipino descent, with their strong and active participation and involvement in U.S. government and politics, and the 250,000 citizens residing in the Philippines, are living proof of how vigorous these ties are. In the aftermath of the typhoons Ketsana and Parma, the U.S. also led the international community in providing relief and recovery assistance to the Philippines. Total U.S. assistance after the typhoons raised millions of cash contributions, as well as in kind. The U.S. Congress also passed House Resolution 800, which expressed condolences to the victims of said typhoon and urged President Barack Obama to continue supporting the Philippines with emergency relief supplies, logistical and transport facilities, assistance, and financial support. Of course, the political leadership of our two countries provide direction and impetus to broader collaboration and cooperation. President Obama recognizes the special ties between our two nations and appreciates the Philippines' contributions to international efforts to organize a more peaceful, more progressive, and more prosperous world. When he received President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo at the White House last June, the first ASEAN head of state, and for that matter, head of government, to be so received, President Obama noted that the Philippines punches above its weight in the international arena. That remark is telling, since it speaks volumes not just about the United States' view of our bilateral ties, but also of Washington's view of the Philippines' potential role in the new regional architecture emerging in Asia. Asia-Pacific is a region of immense diversity. In ASEAN alone, this diversity has enriched the region through its cultures, its languages, its histories, its colonial experiences, its forms of government, its religious practices, and its political system. At any other time in history, and in any other region, this kind of diversity might have led to endless ethnic and religious strife and conflict. ASEAN, however, has resisted polarization and confrontation. Over the years since its founding, four decades ago, ASEAN has evolved into a community that through dialogue and consensus seeking resolves its disputes. Yet dialogue in diversity, while a strength, is also a challenge. For as Southeast Asia grapples with pressing issues and urgent developments, its need for concerted action becomes more and more acute. More and more regional challenges transcend national borders. These challenges have become increasingly interrelated and most often shared. And these solutions require an integrated and interlinked approach. Security issues beset many of our states. Territorial disputes remain potential power kegs of conflict. Terrorism still rears its ugly head. Extremism continues to take root among the politically disenfranchised and economically marginalized. The threat of nuclear proliferation lingers, casting its shadow of uncertainty over the whole of Asia-Pacific. And grinding poverty remains intractable despite the economic successes many of our nations have achieved. Gaps in primary health care and in basic education need to be bridged sooner than later. Environmental degradation endangers individuals, communities, and countries. Global warming and climate change threaten to reverse gains achieved at so great cost by modernizing economies. The competition for dwindling oil and energy resources has added another dimension to the already complex relations in the region, where oil and gas reserves are believed to be found in and around the disputed islands in the South China Sea. It is disputed between the Philippines, China, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei. Piracy on the high seas disrupts the flow of vital goods in the heart of ASEAN, the Strait of Malacca. That is the key choke point in Asia, where about 40% of the world's trade passes through on 50,000 vessels that ply its waters every year. No single state, no matter how powerful, no one nation, no matter how rich, can cope with all of these concerns all by itself. This is why our need for multilateral cooperation is so crucial in our collaborative effort to shape a regional architecture supportive of dialogue. It is in this context that sub-regional organizations are being formed, and at least two attempts already made to organize true pan-Asian organizations. ASEAN stands at the center of this emerging power structure taking shape in Asia. From five original charter members in 1967, ASEAN has expanded its membership to 10. Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. ASEAN has not only prevented the outbreak of regional conflict, the region-wide political stability it brought about by incorporating the three states of communist into China, transformed Southeast Asia into one of the world's most dynamic economic regions. With its adoption of a historic charter in 2008, ASEAN has vested itself with full legal status. It has also enshrined its fundamental values, democracy, respect for human rights and fundamental freedom, good governance, and the rule of law. In the absence of a pan-Asian organization that provides a mechanism for dialogue, ASEAN has become the nucleus of regional dialogue and cooperation. Not only is ASEAN integrating its national economies and is spurring growth and development in the larger East Asia region, it is also addressing security and development issues within and beyond Southeast Asia. Even with the advent of other regional Asian organizations such as SAARC, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and APEC, ASEAN remains the core of many efforts to secure a peaceful, progressive, and prosperous Asia-Pacific. Given China's rise and with both Japan and South Korea wanting to play bigger roles in Asia, ASEAN is the only organization with a ready mechanism for engaging these three Northeast Asian powers, whether individually or collectively. The ASEAN formula for engaging China economically, ASEAN plus one, comes fully on stream this year after several years of early harvest. And ASEAN is confident an East Asian economic grouping of ASEAN 10 plus 3 cannot be far behind, since Japan and Korea surely cannot stay away from the world's great free trade area rising at their very doorsteps. For his part, Japan's Prime Minister Hatoyama proffers the idea of an East Asia community with Japan, China, and Korea at its core. This proposal is still being considered by the ASEAN nations. Other Asian and Asia-Pacific powers regard ASEAN as an important dialogue partner. Among them is India, whose economic and political footprint is growing bigger and bigger. New Delhi, in pursuit of economic modernization, has adopted a look east policy. Australia, New Zealand, and Russia increasingly identify themselves with Asia. All three are also ASEAN dialogue partners. Australia has brought the regional need for an overarching body that would cover a broad spectrum of cooperation. Prime Minister Rudd has proposed creating an Asia-Pacific community with a pan-regional mandate that covers the full policy spectrum. Beyond its regular dialogue partners, ASEAN has also engaged other members in a security forum under the ASEAN Regional Forum that includes Pakistan and DPRK. Indeed, when we hosted the ASEAN Summit, we were able to invite DPRK to attend the six-party talk. That was the first outside of China. And, of course, Ambassador John Negroponte was there representing the Philippines. The vitality of its trade and investment networks is also a key factor in ASEAN's prominent role within the region. The 10 ASEAN states make up a market of close to 600 million people with a combined gross domestic product of nearly $1.5 trillion. Collectively, we are a very important trading partner for the U.S. The 10 member countries of ASEAN comprise the fourth largest export market of the United States and its fifth largest two-way trading partner. Trade between the U.S. and ASEAN continues to grow steadily, and two-way trade in goods totaled $177 billion U.S. dollars in 2008. U.S. export to ASEAN amounted to $67 billion in 2008, only slightly behind exports to China, which registered $70 billion in the same year. Along with other ASEAN economies have shown the greatest resiliency amid the global economic downturn, and they are among those leading the way towards recovery from the financial crisis. Amid this interplay of interest, one might ask, what role can the United States continue to play in reshaping the regional power structure? And how can relations between the Philippines and the United States be strengthened amid the converging and diverging national positions at regional level? The United States maintains a strong and constant presence in the Asia-Pacific. The whole of the Asian continent continues to respect its military power and its ideological attraction. 1 year into President Obama's term, I believe that Asian-U.S. relations have been given a fresh impetus and has entered an even more dynamic phase. Very early in his administration, President Obama signaled a willingness to dialogue and to update vehicles of cooperation with its ASEAN partners. And his avowed policy of re-engaging Asia was welcomed by leaders in the region. Not a few were curious as to how much he would match action with his rhetoric. In the months that followed, the U.S. acted swiftly and convincingly made manifest the priority it accords its relationship with the Asia-Pacific state. In what is perhaps the strongest signal of its re-engagement with Southeast Asia, the Obama administration, at the first possible opportunity, acceded to the Southeast Asia Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, TAC, where its predecessors had feared to tread. Then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton made several trips to the region, including to the Philippines, making sure wherever she went to convey the abiding American interest in maintaining regional peace, progress, and stability. President Obama himself embarked to visit key partners such as China, South Korea, and Japan. He also received at the White House Asian leaders such as the Indian Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, and of course our own President Arroyo. The series of high-level visits President Obama and Secretary Clinton made to East Asia signaled a rekindling, a warming of both bilateral and regional ties. These American initiatives signal that the U.S. is re-engaging Asia, not just to challenge any rising regional power. They demonstrate America's recognition of the value and importance of the individual Asian countries and their critical role in advancing peace, stability, and security throughout Asia-Pacific. Its special ties with the Philippines have proved to be an anchor of the U.S. engagement in the Asia-Pacific. Philippine-U.S. relations are a strategic partnership, nurtured not only by enduring historical ties, but also by an adherence to shared values, especially by a commitment to political freedom, representative democracy, and individual enterprise. From combating extremism to waging a war against poverty, the partnership between our two countries is multifaceted and forward-looking. Compelled as we were by shared interests and complementary priorities to meet global and regional challenges, we expect to open fresh avenues for greater cooperation in the coming years. Ours is a long-standing and well-established alliance, which Secretary Clinton herself described recently as among the most successful bilateral partnerships in modern history. The best measure of the success of this partnership, I believe, extends beyond the confines of our bilateral relations. The Philippines is a country with a global outlook that is also deeply aware of its regional responsibility. We are intent on enhancing our contributions to the region and the community of nations. As current coordinator of the ASEAN-US dialogue relations, we managed a milestone early on, the convening last November of the first meeting ever between the leaders of all 10 ASEAN countries and the American president in Singapore. A second leaders' meeting is to be held this year. We're also working to establish an ASEAN-US eminent persons group that will give both visionary focus and pragmatic advice to our dialogue relation. On human rights, the Philippines continues to be a strong ally of the United States in protecting and promoting basic individual rights in the region. Our country strongly endorsed the creation of a human rights body within ASEAN and is actively engaged in putting together the mechanisms for such body. And ours is the strongest and sometimes solidary voice in ASEAN, calling for the unconditional release of Aung San Suu Kyi and for concrete progress on Myanmar's tortuous road to democracy, starting with the freeing of Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD leaders, and allowing all of them, if they so desire, to participate in the election in September. Otherwise, the Philippines said that such an election would be a farce of Myanmar's own roadmap to democracy. For the East Asian security, the U.S.-Philippine Mutual Defense Alliance is a key stabilizing influence. At the same time, collaboration between the Philippines and American defense and security establishment under our visiting forces agreement facilitates the collective effort to neutralize extreme elements operating clandestinely in the region. Collaboration among our police and intelligence agencies in keeping down the notorious Abu Sayyaf group, Jemaya Islamiya, and other terrorist groups linked with Al-Qaeda have limited their ability to disrupt the lives of East Asians who want only to go on with their lives in peace. In recognition of our vital role, we were acknowledged by the United States as a major non-NATO ally in October 2003, the first to be recognized as such in Southeast Asia. U.S. assistance to the Philippines has risen over the years, and we get our fair share of official development assistance. Of course, we know by now that fanatic terrorism and radical insurgency cannot be defeated decisively by the force of arms alone. Winning the support of ordinary people for our aims and our efforts must override all other goals. That is why we in the Philippines, with American support, now combine soft and hard power to counter terrorist threats and radical attacks, to build long-term peace and development, especially in the strategic Mindanao island. For this same reason, we are at the forefront of global efforts to build bridges of understanding between peoples of the great religions through interfaith dialogues. We found this dialogue useful in heading off extremist appeals to people who have been marginalized by material poverty and disenfranchised by spiritual alienation. In March this year, the Philippines will host the special non-aligned movement for a ministerial meeting on interfaith dialogue for peace and development. This meeting will move further along this crucial initiative that the Philippines steered to the United Nations system. This year, too, our two countries have a unique opportunity to move against the global threat of nuclear proliferation. We shall be working relentlessly for the success of the Nuclear Security Summit called by President Obama in mid-April, in which President Arroyo has been invited to take part. In the following month of May, the Philippines will assume the presidency of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference in New York. With potential nuclear powers being Asian powers, the problem of nuclear proliferation is compelling for our home region. Another grave challenge that demands concerted effort is climate change, which we can ease only by severe austerities in energy use and in protecting the environment. And we hope that from the failure in Copenhagen, something concrete happens binding treaty with verifiable international monitoring somewhere between now and Mexico. The joint efforts of the Asia-Pacific countries and of the United States in the Coral Triangle Initiative have attracted awareness and support for programs that aim to protect marine biodiversity while also protecting the livelihoods of about 120 million people in seacoast communities in the area around the Philippines, Papua New Guinea, Malaysia, Indonesia, the Solomon Islands. Amid the evolving, lastly, it is clear that as regional and global realities evolve, so too will the dynamic ties between the Philippines and the United States. Amid the evolving regional architecture in the Asia-Pacific, one thing remains constant. We who share political and moral ideals and values must continue to deepen our engagement with one another, even as we seek to broaden our engagement with the others. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I'd like to now ask a good friend and definitely an eminent person when it comes to the U.S.-Philippine relationship and U.S.-ASEAN relationship, a man who's put in many hours on these issues, John Negroponte, to say a few words about the Secretary's remarks and lead us into some discussion. We have an open question and answer period. As you know, Ambassador Negroponte is former Deputy Secretary of State. He's the first ever Director of National Intelligence, the U.S. Perm Rep to the UN, Ambassador to Iraq, and had nearly 40 years of service, 40 years in the Foreign Service, Ambassador to Honduras, Mexico, and perhaps most importantly this morning, Ambassador to the Philippines. He was much loved when he was there. He was a great leader. I had the honor to work closely with him when I was president of the U.S.-ASEAN Business Council, and we did a lot of work on that relationship when he was there. He provided tremendous leadership. So please join me in welcoming John Negroponte to say a few words. John.
Thank you, Ernie. Thank you, Secretary Romulo, for your very complete review of both the U.S.-Philippine relations and the situation in Southeast Asia and in East Asia generally. I know that most people in the audience really want to hear what you have to say and follow up with questions and will want to make comments, but let me say a few brief words. First of all, as Ernie mentioned, I was ambassador of the Philippines from 1993 to 1996, which is an interesting period because I was the first post-bases ambassador, if you will. We got to Manila about a year after the last ship had weighed anchor out of Subic Bay, so befell me and my team to sort of pursue the other aspects of the relationship, which frankly turned out to be extremely interesting, and there was life after bases, and I think we found an awful lot to do. At the time, President Fidel Ramos was the president of the country, and one of the focuses of the relationship at the time, and I think it was very important because it captured a lot of the history that Secretary Romulo was referring to earlier. We were celebrating the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, and which President Ramos determined would be celebrated in the following manner, that we would have the reenactment of all the key battles that led to the liberation of the country, starting with the landing in Leyte, in October of 1944, therefore October of 1994. And actually, it was a kind of a Hollywood production, the first scene. We had an American actor playing the role of MacArthur. He sort of tripped getting out of the landing craft. Some people say that's what MacArthur did the first time.
I see.
But it was really very, very interesting, and we went all the way to Baguio in, I guess it was late August of 94, and that's in the ambassador's residence there, and the high commissioner's where they signed the armistice. So that was a very meaningful experience. President Clinton came out, of course. He came out for a visit. And so there was a lot going on. I go back to my own career all the way to 1967. I was working in the political section in Saigon at the time. I don't know if Bob Miller was there then or he'd already left Saigon, but I recall that we were in the political section. We were looking at this news about ASEAN. We wonder what that means, because it wasn't billed then as a politico or a strategic kind of organization. It was more like social and economic, if I remember correctly, and it was kind of loosely worded. It wasn't a particularly concrete organization at that time. So it's really interesting to see how something that starts in a kind of a rather general way has emerged and evolved into the complexity of arrangements and meetings and fora that you described in your talk, and to go from the original five to now 10, and actually I guess Brunei was the first one to come along in addition to the founders. But it's fascinating to see how that has evolved, and I think it's extremely positive. I do think East Asia still, it's not clear yet, to my way of thinking, or obvious, exactly what ultimate architecture might emerge from this entire situation. When I was deputy secretary, one of the jobs I had was to follow a bit the six-party talks on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and there was a working group. One of the several working groups was a working group on architecture for the maintenance of peace and security in Northeast Asia after the satisfactory resolution of the denuclearization question. And that particular working group, at least as of when I left it, had never really gotten very far. It was still at a pretty high level of generality. So that's all still to be determined. And I think that from a United States perspective, the core element of our involvement in the East Asia Pacific region still is our treaty arrangements, right? It's Japan, which is a real important cornerstone. It's the Philippines. It's the treaty with Korea, Australia, and so forth. So that's still the basic arrangement, but I think we, like everybody else, is open to the idea of something else evolving over time, either as a, probably not as a substitute for, but as a supplement to the existing arrangements, because this is probably the part of the world where the power arrangements are still the most sort of traditional, if you will. They're most like the 19th century. I mean, it's Russia and China and Japan, the United States, you know, big players. ASEAN, if you will, as a bloc. The other thing I'd say is when I served in Manila, it was kind of the heyday of economic growth in the region, 93 to 96. It was really booming. And when Ernie directed the ASEAN-US Business Council, one of the highlights every year was our annual visit. It was sort of like a door knock. We all the U.S. ambassadors to Southeast Asia, and we'd visit three or four cities in the United States, ending up in Washington, going up to visit Congress. And there was an enormous amount of interest in business opportunities in that part of the world. And things were really humming along very, very nicely. And then, of course, the Asian financial crisis came, the bank failures in, I guess, first in Thailand, and then the thing spread to Indonesia, and then it became sort of generalized. And my sense is that Southeast Asia is kind of just coming out of that right now. And so let's hope that trend continues, because I think that at the moment there's a lot of untapped and unrealized potential in Southeast Asia. You know, they talk about the BRICS, okay? So that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But I think there's the next tier. There's several countries in Southeast Asia that you could put in that category of the next tier countries. The Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, for sure, as well. I mean, just like Turkey or so some of the countries in other parts of the world, Egypt and so forth. So I think a lot of people are going to be looking at the economic opportunities in your part of the world over the next 10, 20 years. And I think there's a lot that can be gotten out of that mutually, I mean, by both sides. And in that vein, I was looking in a course that I teach, looking at some demographic data the other day about the world demographic profile in the year 2050. And, of course, the Philippines is one of those high population. I mean, it's going to have about, it's going to be within the top 12 countries in terms of population in the world. In 1950, out of the top 12 populated countries in the world, five of them, besides the United States, were OECD countries. They were Japan, UK, France, Italy, etc. None of those countries in 2050 are going to be in the top 12, except the only Western economy, if you will, that'll be on that list will be the United States. We will maintain our place as the third most populous. I think actually CSIS did the study. It's a very, very good demographic piece of work. But the Philippines figures prominently up there, and what was viewed in the past as perhaps a little bit of a disadvantage to have, you know, a lot of demographic pressure and a lot of young people can, I think, in the years ahead, be converted into some real kind of economic advantage, provided you can educate your people adequately. But there's going to be such a shortage of working-age people in the more advanced economies that I would have thought a country like the Philippines has a lot to benefit from that. Maybe just lastly, if I could, there is so much to say, but I know that there are questions from the audience, and I think we ought to, and Ernie, I'm sure, will have some direction that he wants to steer us in. But I do, in the connection with terrorism, want to mention how fate plays an interesting role here. It certainly wasn't obvious to me in January of 1995 when we disrupted, that is to say, basically the Philippine police, disrupted a plot to blow up 9 or 10 United States airliners and a plot to kill the Pope on his visit the following month, I think it was, to Manila, that was an al-Qaeda plot. And that was one of the... And you know what? They come back and they keep trying to do the same things again. It's really quite interesting. To my way of thinking, and we have the Philippine law enforcement authorities to thank for that, and the fire department, I think, which this all happened. The plot got revealed because there was a fire in an apartment where these fellows were playing with chemicals. Yeah, about 1,000 yards from the U.S. Embassy. It's interesting with this Christmas plot we had on December 25th that, again, you know, they come back and they try to do some of these things over and over again, just like they attacked the World Trade Center. And, of course, one of the people involved in that January episode was Ramzi Youssef, who escaped back to Pakistan and ultimately was turned over to us and was convicted for his role in the first World Trade Center bombing. So it's interesting how this international terrorist situation is linked together in so many different ways. And sometimes with the benefit of hindsight, you even see more connections than you originally appreciated. So we really value, and I certainly did when I was both at the UN and as Director of National Intelligence, when I did take a trip in my official capacity to Manila and as Deputy Secretary, we value our cooperation with your authorities in that area, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for that.
John, thank you very much. really great to, first of all, hear the Secretary's comments, hear your reactions. I think it's that kind of dialogue that we want to promote with this new Banyan Tree forum. So thank you both for that. What I'd like to do is open up the floor for questions. I'll start with a question, but I encourage you all to use this opportunity to have such incredible resources here. I hope you'll take advantage and ask some good questions, and then we'll look to wrap up. But I wanted to ask something that you didn't really touch on. But of course, when we think about the Philippines, it's on our minds. Of course, you have an election coming up in May, and we've been following it very closely with a lot of interest. As Foreign Secretary, I won't ask you for too political a question. You know, domestic politics, I know, may not have, you know, may not be what you want to talk about here. But I think for us, you know, we're looking at the candidates, and I think one of the big questions that I have is, do you see either of, or any of the main camps likely to change sort of the core focus of Philippine foreign policy? You've outlined the stance of the Philippines over quite a broad period, and certainly brought us up to date. And the Philippines' leadership has been really important. Should we expect any changes? And what do you see in the near future in the Philippines?
The elections, as you know, will take place in May of this year, so that's barely 4 months from now, and we will have an automated election. This is the first time that automation will be there, and I think everybody's geared to that, to make sure, starting from the president, the administration, and of course all the candidates, that it should be a fair, clean, and credible election. We have to make sure that it's clean, fair, and credible. And I think all efforts are directed towards that objective. Now, as to who will win, that, of course, is a question that I would not like to venture to guess at this point. But if you look at the polls, there are certainly two candidates who are ahead. And well, to name names, one is Senator Benigno Aquino III. And, of course, we know who Benigno Aquino III is. The other one is the former Senate President, Senator Manuel Villar. Now, and, of course, there are others who are running. I think there are six more who are running.
Right.
But if we focus on these two, I believe that, by and large, they will look at the foreign policy that we have pursued. And, well, for instance, our foreign policy reflects fundamental principles that reflect the national interest and our global outlook. So on that basis, for instance, what are the foreign policy objectives that we have? We have the three pillars, which is the promotion, the protection of the rights, and promotion of the interests and welfare of Filipinos abroad. Well, I would not say that they would deviate from that. Another pillar that we have is the preservation and enhancement of national security. Again, these are embodied in many of our programs, including the Visiting Forces Agreement. You know, and then there is the promotion and attainment of economic security. Again, we are involved here in the visits and programs that we have with all countries. And then we have eight realities of our foreign policy. What are these eight realities? Well, the first, well, not necessarily in that order, but let me mention the first, that our relations with China, Japan, and the U.S. Would have a determining influence as far as the security situation and economic advancement is concerned. So again, we hope that they will pursue those realities. The second one is more and more our policy decisions will be in the context of ASEAN. And I've just described what ASEAN is all about. The international Islamic community will have more and more influence on how we see things. You see, we have 10% of our population is Muslim. We are engaged in becoming an observer in the Organization of Islamic Countries. And we have good relations with the Islamic community. And that's the reason why in March we are hosting the special NAM ministerial meeting on interfaith dialogue. We are inviting all, but we are inviting the Muslim leaders and countries to attend that. Then, of course, the other foreign policy reality we have is our relations with multilaterals, with the United States, and the regional relations. ASEAN is one of them. East Asia Forum is another one of them. East Asia Forum being ASEAN 10 plus Japan, Korea, China, India, Australia, and New Zealand. So these are the foreign policy realities that we have. And, of course, we just passed our baselines law. The reason why we passed that baselines law is because there is a deadline in the United Nations. And we passed that baseline law, and it is under this administration that we finally have a baselines law and an extended continental shelf because we want other countries to respect our territorial integrity, our sovereignty. Now, you cannot have a territorial integrity if you don't have a baselines law. So we passed that. So all of these, you know, are the three pillars of our foreign policy, the eight realities of our foreign policy, our espousal of interfaith dialogue. We are going to be the president of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Committee in May. So all of these are fundamental principles which reflect our national interest. And I would say that the candidates, whoever they are, should pursue these policies.
If I could ask you a question, Mr. Secretary, because I thought it was interesting what you said about the relationship with China, Japan, and the United States. But I was wondering if you see other countries growing in importance in terms of your foreign policy. You mentioned India earlier, and I was wondering, do you sense that they, for example, are seeking to play a greater role, for example, in commercial activities? I know they now have a very dynamic business sector, and have you been working on that aspect of your foreign policy and economic relations?
We have very. In fact, India has this policy of look east, mm-hmm. and it includes, of course, the ASEAN and the other countries in the east. And we are developing a robust relations in economics, in political relations with India. And we have had high-level visits with India, both the president of India visiting the Philippines and our president visiting India. And in fact, we are going to have a bilateral consultation between the foreign minister of India and myself sometime in the latter part of March. So I think India and the Philippines, and I think ASEAN are developing good relations. And that is why India, as well as China, Japan, and Korea, and Australia, and New Zealand, are part of the East Asia Forum. And they're also dialogue partners of ASEAN. And so I think we are well placed there in our relation, both ASEAN and the Philippines.
Thank you. I'm going to throw the floor open. Chris, I saw your hand first. Yeah. And Tom.
Sure. Yeah. Chris Dorval, I actually work for myself, but I do a lot of work in the Philippines with the president and with the foreign secretary. I have a question that kind of goes to what you were talking about on this persistence of these terrorist groups and the nexus to the Philippines and elsewhere. But we've seen increased American cooperation, a lot of boots on the ground and intelligence work in the south of the Philippines. We've been working to wipe out the Abu Sayyaf and the JI, and yet they are persistently there and still. I don't know if they're strong, but they haven't gone away, and there's some indications that it's gone up. And I'm curious what the factors are that allows them to continue to thrive. And in other words, is it driven by conditions in the Philippines? Is it a regional thing because of these groups move between Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines? I'm just curious, why have we not been able to contain once and for all these groups in some of those remote islands of the Philippines?
Well, we are doing our best, not only in the Philippines but in the region. And one of the reasons why we feel that the visiting forces agreement is very relevant and very important is because it gives our intelligence, our police, and our military the tools in order to improve their capability and capacity, especially the intelligence fusion. And of course, we pull all this intelligence not only with the U.S., but also with our neighbors. And, of course, there are other factors involved. That's why we are saying that we cannot decisively defeat terrorism just by force of arms. We have to have the soft and the hard power. And one of the soft power, of course, is livelihood, economic development, peace. That is why we are so focused on having that peace agreement with the MILF, because once we have the peace agreement, then development is sure to follow. It's when you have an unresolved conflict that investments and people are not ready to put their investments there. But also part of the soft power is the interfaith dialogue. And the Bishop Ulama Conference in the Philippines, the bishop or the Christians, Catholic, and the Muslims, they're able to go to the roots, to the grassroots, and neutralize the extremists, and hopefully bring them to the center. And of course, like I said, we are going to have a conference this March with the non-aligned movement. But we invite all those interested in interfaith dialogue for peace and development. So between the hard power, which we are trying to improve our capabilities, including the intelligence fusion, and the soft power, then we hope that we will continue to minimize. I think the problem will be there for some time, so I don't think that it will completely disappear. But we have neutralized a lot of these Abu Sayyaf, Jemaya Islamiya, and other terrorist group connected with Al-Qaeda. And I think it's a constant struggle. But we also feel that it's development in the area that will improve the lives of the people in the area, who, by the way, are tired of this conflict and violence. So that finally will be the one to bring peace and stability in the region and in the Philippines.
Thank you. John, did you want to comment on that?
Only to ask or comment, I think I'm right in saying that while it may not be completely contained, it is It's not generalized throughout the country, and in that sense, it is localized, I think. And right. So in that sense, while it's not an ideal situation, you could say it's a manageable situation.
I saw Tom, and then Doug is next.
Mr. Secretary, I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council and the Malaysia America Society. You've spoken eloquently about ASEAN and about the Philippines' promotion of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. Yet you've also talked about the issues involving consensus-making, decision-making in ASEAN. And I wonder if you could share with us some of the efforts of the Philippines to promote democracy, human rights, and some of the frustrations in dealing with a system that makes it difficult to come out with forthright decisions.
That's a good question, because you have to be patient when you are dealing with consensus building. You have to be patient. It doesn't come immediately. And one very good case to highlight that is the case of Myanmar. In the case of Myanmar, we keep on passing resolution that Myanmar should honor the roadmap to democracy that they themselves presented and promised will happen. And we say, in order to make a reality, at least the beginning of the realization of that roadmap to democracy, they should free Aung San Suu Kyi. We all know that the charges against her is a farce. It's something that in the ordinary courts of law in our country and other countries would have been thrown out. You know, so we say free her. And also allow her and the NLD to be part and participate in the September election, if they so desire. Let us remember that Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD won overwhelmingly, when was that, 10 years ago, 89, they won overwhelmingly the election. But this was not honored. You know, I am probably the only foreign minister in the ASEAN who has met Aung San Suu Kyi. That was in 1995 or 96, when she was still not confined. And she was telling me, and then our foreign minister then, at the time I was a senator, she was telling us that, you know, I do not want to kick out the junta. We won, but we will rule together with them. And he said, if they accept this, then I think we can evolve eventually to real democracy, a real election. But we don't want that to happen immediately. 1995, 1996, that was more than 10 years ago. And at the time, she was free. So we have to be patient, because I still believe that we have to have consensus. We cannot just use force against them, for instance. But also there is the reality that we may not have the cohesion with the other powers. Just like in Iran, you know, in Iran, I read in the papers that they have to talk with China, you know, in order to impose the sanctions, you know. So it's a work in process. In the case of Myanmar and in the case of DPRK, well, of course, you have to contend with China also. But also in the case of Myanmar, India, and even some of these ASEAN countries, because they have, well, you know, they have commercial interests, you know. So all of these, but in my view, it's better to continue negotiation, consensus building, trying to build up public pressure against the Myanmar government. So it is in that sense that to us, we welcome the re-engagement of the United States in Burma. I think with that visit of Senator Jim Webb and then followed by Assistant Secretary Campbell, I think this is the step in the right direction. After all, we have not done that except the UN for the last 10 years. So it's time to change a new, to adopt a new tack. So I guess it's not a satisfactory answer, but we cannot be too impatient about it, you know.
Okay. Thank you, Secretary. Doug?
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. I'm Doug Hartog, retired diplomat and an international trade consultant now. And I'd like to turn you to the world of trade relations and trade agreements in Asia and in Southeast Asia, I think. For many years, I followed our trade relations with ASEAN, having served in Malaysia and Laos and other places. And even to this day, coming back here to Washington and watching how our trade is evolving with the region, you gave some interesting statistics. It's obviously a very important dynamic, as it has been, as Ambassador Negroponte referred to, back to the early 90s when the ambassador's tour was on and there was a lot of excitement. Ernie was there, I was there. Now as I watch Southeast Asia and I watch Asia in general, the picture is beginning to shift a little bit, I think, for the United States. And that is, we see India with a free trade agreement with Southeast Asia, with ASEAN. We see ASEAN plus three evolving in the direction, particularly on the economic side, of reducing barriers, facilitating trade and investment with China specifically, but also with Korea and Japan. And I get the sense increasingly of sort of the United States, despite its great economic spread and power, increasingly on the outside watching not so much barriers thrown up to the United States, but barriers for all the Asian countries themselves coming down, which has the same effect, if you will. I'd be interested in your views about what do you think needs to be done to help promote, whether it's formally through agreements or informally through other actions, a way of making sure that the United States' role and involvement in Southeast Asia economic growth and trade and investment remains as strong today as it has been in decades past.
You know, we have been hoping that at Davos, the so many World Economic Forum that many leaders have been attending, and we always talk to Peter Lamy, that eventually the Doha round will be a reality, because I think that's really is the answer to all of this. But there are certain factors that have not made that a reality. There are certain countries involved. In ASEAN, starting January 1st, we have the ASEAN Free Trade Agreement with China, with Japan, with Korea, with India, with Australia and New Zealand. So, and we are working on our bilateral agreements with each of these countries. Now, I believe that the United States should still be an economic factor. After all, for the last so many years or decades, the United States has given a security umbrella as well as market access to the countries in Asia. That's perhaps one of the reasons why the tigers in Asia, you know, have prospered. But in the 21st century, as Lee Kuan Yew was saying, you know, the 21st century would be important battleground for supremacy in the Pacific. And the United States should continue not to lose ground, but to gain ground in the Pacific, in Asia. Otherwise, they cannot be world leaders. You know? So I don't know what to advise the United States, but I think the United States, even as it provides security umbrella. The market access, of course, is a little bit diminished because of the economic downturn, but the United States must continue to be present in Asia-Pacific.
Can I follow up with it? What about an ASEAN-U.S. free trade agreement?
I think we have now the TIFA, the Trade Investment Framework Agreement. Mm. But we have to move forward beyond that. You know? And I think the U.S. has with Singapore such a free trade agreement, but I am not aware that they have with other countries, including the Philippines. Well, you've been involved in this.
Right? I have, yeah. The current status, we have a free trade agreement with Singapore, of course. Yeah. And we tried to negotiate free trade agreements with Thailand and Malaysia. They got stuck. And the new trade policy for Asia, for the United States, that the president was able to commit to ahead of his trip to Asia and that he announced in Japan was a commitment to negotiate the TPP, which I think there's a lot of questions about that. What is the U.S. trade policy? What are we really doing with the TPP? And I think ASEAN, I'm glad this was brought out because I think the United States really has to think about it in terms of a strategy. What are we going to do with this TIFA that we have with ASEAN? Do we need to step that up into a full FTA discussion? And so far it's been just too hard, not the time to do trade because of the political environment here. But I think these are hard questions that Americans have to ask of themselves.
So you would say, though, I mean, just objectively, is it the stumbling block been us or ASEAN? It's been us.
Correct.
Up until now, right?
I think it is.
Yeah. Let me ask the Secretary, though, but would the ASEAN, would you welcome a free trade agreement with the United States?
Oh, yeah, even the Philippines, I think, you know. Early in the administration of President Arroyo, you know. Of course, the TIFA was good, but I think in ASEAN, we would like to have a free trade agreement. In fact, what we want to have is the Doha, the World Trade Free Trade Agreement, whatever you call that, you know. And I remember that during the time of the previous administration, we were told that they were rushing this because there was more likelihood of it passing the Congress at the time than the new Congress. You know, I don't know if that's still true, you know. But that was really the issue. And, of course, there are other countries there like if I recall, Brazil and then India.
Right.
So these are the countries that are the Super Bowl players, you know, if you might use that term, you know.
We have time for maybe one or two more questions. Laura, did you?
TPP was my question.
Oh, okay. Is there another question? Any? In the back.
Hey, Foster Klug with the Associated Press. I wanted to ask you again about Burma and sanctions. The U.S. administration has said they're willing to talk to Burma, but they reserve the right to impose even harsher sanctions should some of the things they're looking for in democracy and Suu Kyi not pan out. Is that something that the Philippines supports, and would ASEAN members support any kind of strengthening of sanctions if Burma continues to stall and not show progress on democracy? Thanks.
Let me be candid about you know, the problems there, because it's not only ASEAN that has relations with Burma or Myanmar. And so unless we can get together, you know, of course, even in ASEAN, we may have a problem with sanctions, you know. But assuming that we get the ASEAN together, but it's not only the ASEAN, but other countries around, you know, who have big investments in Burma, like, you know, they're developing pipelines to Burma, they're developing infrastructure, you know. When I went to Naypyidaw, again, I was invited when we were chair of the ASEAN summit. you know, there was nothing in Naypyidaw. That is the new administrative capital. You know, from Rangoon, they went to Naypyidaw. But they told me that the Chinese were building the airport, the runway, and the facilities there. Now, I've not been back there, but those who have been there tell me that the airport is now built, and they have hotels, and you know, they have houses and structures. So, you see, these are the things, you know. So it's a tough thing, you know. If we cannot resolve the DPRK, that's the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, if we are having difficulty with the IAEA and Iran, you know, I mean, what is the priority of Myanmar and Burma? I mean, I ask that question. You know. But we have to be patient. That's what I always say. We have to be patient.
Been a lot of patience on Burma. I think we have one more question in the back. And that'll be the last question.
Sure. Sean Tandon with AFP. Actually, I was going to ask something similar to Foster's question, but related to Burma as well, with the elections coming up, what's the sense that you get? Do you sense that you mentioned September as a date for them? Do you get the sense from your contacts there that it's certainly going to go ahead in September? And do you get a sense that there is a possibility? What's your assessment of whether opposition figures may be able to participate? What's your assessment of the... What do you think currently is the situation there with the election?
Well, let me say that I believe the elections would go through in September, around that time. And I believe that perhaps from what we hear, that Aung San Suu Kyi would be released before the election. But whether they would repeal or amend the law which prohibits Aung San Suu Kyi, if so desire, to run, and certain members of the NLD, I'm not sure that they would do that. And therefore, to all intents and purposes, there is an election. They would have some NLD members, but Aung San Suu Kyi, for one reason or another, and some key members will be disqualified from running. So we have issued a strong statement that if this is so, then it's a mockery of Burma's own roadmap to democracy.
Hope I'm wrong. Yeah. I just got back from Bangkok, and I can tell you that that sounds pretty accurate. I talked to some Burmese there, and that looks like that's about my understanding too of the situation. But happy to follow up with you if you're interested, Sean. Ladies and gentlemen, would you join me in giving a big hand to the secretary and. I know you're all anxious to get out there and find out if it's snowing yet and make your way. The secretary's headed to New York, so we need to get him on his way, too. But I want to thank you in particular for coming out. This is the inaugural meeting of the Banyan Tree Forum. We've created this here to really create a deep dialogue with Southeast Asia's leaders, and it couldn't have been done in a more classy fashion. And I'm so glad that my friend Bert Romulo was able to kick this forum off. It's the idea of a banyan tree, of course, is the strength of many standing as one. And that comes from the heart. And it's certainly, you get that feeling from our friends in the Philippines and particularly from you, Secretary Romulo. So thank you very much. And I hope all of you will continue to come and join in this forum as we hold other events. Thank you very much.